Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Conventional wisdom suggests that World War II transformed the United States into a global power, not only militarily and economically, but also culturally. America, it's commonly believed, became a cultural superpower, exporting to the world everything from television shows to Hollywood films, fast food restaurants to professional sports. Our guest this week, Richard Pels, has a different take on all of this, and he'll be joining us in a few minutes. After that, Alice George will give us yet another historical comparison for our current involvement in Iraq, that of presidential leadership as exercised by George W. Bush and John Kennedy during the Cuban Missile Crisis. But first, Dan Roberts concludes his three-part A Moment in Time series on the Alien and Sedition Acts.
Attempting to damage their political enemies, Thomas Jefferson's Republicans, in 1798 the Federalist majority in Congress put the final nail in their own political coffin.
A Moment in Time with Dan Roberts.
Anger against France was in the air. War seemed imminent. The people were aroused, and the Federalists in Congress, alarmed at the growing power of the Republican followers of Thomas Jefferson, decided to settle some political scores. They passed and pressed an allegedly reluctant President John Adams to sign the Alien Acts and the Sedition Act, three of the most reprehensible pieces of legislation in U.S. history. The Alien Acts more than double the time immigrants had to live in the U.S. before achieving citizenship and, in addition, allow the president to unilaterally deport foreigners he considered dangerous. The Sedition Act provided penalties for those convicted of criticizing the U.S., the Congress, or the president. The targets were obvious. French and Irish immigrants almost all tended to support the Republicans, and nearly all of the more than two dozen prosecuted under the Sedition Act were Republican newspaper editors or activists. It was a transparent exercise in political repression, and in clear violation of the First Amendment's protection of free speech. Reaction was swift and vigorous. The Virginia and Kentucky legislatures passed resolves authored by James Madison and Jefferson, respectively, which denounced the acts as unconstitutional. The dispute with France was resolved, and when war fever subsided and rationality returned, the public voted overwhelmingly for the Republicans in the election of 1800. The Federalists thus began their long slide to political oblivion. At the University of Richmond, this is Dan Roberts.
French historians report that they've solved one of the country's most enduring mysteries. They claim a pickled and shrunken heart that has roamed Europe for more than two centuries belonged to Louis XVII, son of Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette. Louis was imprisoned with his parents in 1792 in the aftermath of the French Revolution. As the uncrowned king after his father's execution, he endured 3 years in jail before dying in 1795. At which point a doctor who conducted the post-mortem smuggled his heart out of jail and stored it in an urn in his library. 2 years ago, DNA tests established that the heart belonged to a relative of Marie Antoinette, but only after historians traced the heart's history for the past 200 years were they able to determine beyond reasonable doubt that it belonged to the boy king. The heart will now be buried in France's royal crypt at Saint-Denis, north of Paris. And from another, less grisly article in the news, linguists have discovered a still-surviving version of the sacred religious language of the ancient Maya, the great ancient Central American civilization. Until now, Mayan hieroglyphic texts have largely defied interpretation, but now archaeologists and linguists have identified a little-known native Indian language in Guatemala as the descendant of the elite tongue. They hope that it will serve as a living Rosetta Stone and lead to our better understanding of aspects of Mayan civilization lost for centuries. This is Talking History. Americans traveling in Europe are often greeted with the familiar sight of fast food restaurants, television shows, and cultural icons such as Michael Jordan. Even Disney's there, leading many to write about American influence on the rest of the world. Most believe that it's a one-way street, that it's America that is influencing the world. But not our guest this week. Richard Pels suggests that it is more complicated than that, and that there's a more subtle interplay between Europe and America, and even that each side of the Atlantic has transformed the other. Richard Pels is a professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin, and the author of Not Like Us, How Europeans Have Loved, Hated, and Transformed American Culture Since World War II, published by Basic Books. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you.
A couple startup questions. First of all, you start your book in 1945. Are we to interpret that as your way of saying that prior to World War II, the United States was a comparatively minor power in world culture?
No, not really. Actually, the first chapter of the book deals with the first half of the 20th century before the Second World War. And although it's certainly true that on a political and economic level, the United States was far less important than it would be during and after World War II, culturally, it had become increasingly important, certainly by the 1920s. And if you look at the exports of American products or American movies or American jazz or even American public relations techniques and even American tourists, you begin to get, even early on in the 20th century, much of the foundations for what comes later.
Okay, so we're not dealing with a major sea change here, but there is a change, and I'm wondering if this relates somehow to the U.S. economic and military prowess at the end of World War II.
Well, there's no question that at the end of the Second World War, the United States had become the elephant in everyone's living room. People could have ignored America to some extent in the early 20th century, but certainly not after 1945. And a lot of that, of course, does have to do with the emergence of America as a global military, political, and economic power, so that America's culture becomes even more important in terms of people having to respond to it than it did in the teens and 20s. In addition to that, by the 1950s, you get the advent of mass tourism and certainly jet transatlantic airline travel beginning at the end of the 1950s. And that means that more Americans in person are in people's living rooms, at least metaphorically, than they had ever been before.
Now, I thought two of your most interesting chapters were the chapters on transatlantic misunderstandings. Let's begin with the first, American misunderstandings of Europe.
Well, I think one of the things that's characterized both Europe and the United States in terms of the way they look at one another is that there has been, going back really at least 200 years, if not longer, a series of myths and stereotypes about how Americans regard Europeans and how Europeans regard America. The very notion that Americans love to think of themselves as inhabiting a new world, which was innocent but also buoyant and optimistic and progressive, had not just comparative notions but a certain moral connotations as well. If America was a youthful, innocent, forward-looking place, a new world, then Europe as an old world was characterized, at least in American eyes, by decadence, by fatigue, by social constriction, by social conflict, by ideology, and by wars, all of which, of course, American immigrants had been trying to escape.
Now, Europeans, were they irritated by this perspective, or did they just think Americans were just naive?
I would say both. In addition to which, European travelers who came to the United States even in the 19th century, people like Charles Dickens, for example, looked upon America as a new world, all right, but a world without culture often, without civilization, a violent world, a vulgar world, a materialistic world, a greedy world. Dickens famously said that Americans were always in search of the almighty dollar. And I think if you look at those kinds of stereotypes, those kinds of images have persisted from the 19th century until now.
So we're talking now about the reverse, European misunderstandings of America?
Yes, okay. Yes.
Can you give me another example of that?
I think, you know, that there was always a sense that somehow Americans lacked a kind of refinement. Certainly they lacked a high culture in terms of ballet or painting or architecture. or science. And, of course, some of that was true, at least in the 19th century. It was less and less true by the 20th century. One of the ironies about this relationship and the misunderstandings behind it is that up until the 1930s, Americans had always thought of themselves as being culturally inferior to Europe. But by the 1930s, when you get a mass emigration to America of scholars, artists, filmmakers, many of them fleeing for their lives from Nazism, America becomes now the shelter and the haven of Western culture as it had not been, or as it had not been thought to have been in the 19th and early 20th century.
Okay. Well, you address this from many different perspectives. You talk about the ways in which we, the United States, have Americanized Europe's economic life since World War II. Tell us about that.
Well, actually, I would say that in general sense, I think a good deal of the talk about Americanization is overrated. It is certainly true that America had a profound influence on European political and economic life in the 1940s and 1950s, certainly under the auspices of things like the Marshall Plan. But what strikes me as more interesting is the ways in which, over certainly the past 30 or 40 years, Europe economically and increasingly politically has diverged from the American model. The European welfare state, which was also a creation of the post-war years, is obviously far more expansive and also far more expensive than anything contemplated by American politicians from Franklin Roosevelt until the present.
And what about social life? How do we influence social life in Europe?
Well, again, I think that there is certainly a sense that with the coming of everything from American-style supermarkets to Walmarts to theme parks, that European leisure time, European recreation, the way people spend their hours off their jobs has been influenced by American styles of entertainment and American styles of leisure. But I still think that if, for example, you look at the way Europeans use their leisure time in their cities, that's very different from the way Americans use their cities, in large part because European cities are still places where leisure and work, commerce and culture are intimately related, where the great phenomena of American urban development in the 20th century has really been the development of suburbia.
Let's touch on the last area that you develop, which is the American influence on European mass culture. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, there I think it's clear that American influence on mass culture has been probably greater than in any other realm, certainly greater, I think, than either in political or economic or social life. The artifacts of American mass culture are ubiquitous. All you have to do is look at movie marquees in any European city. Something like 80% of all the movies shown in European theaters, with the exception of France, are American-made. And up until recently, American television programs have dominated the European airwaves. That's become somewhat less true over the past 5 or 10 years. American novels, best-selling novels, authors like John Grisham, are as well known in Europe as they are in the United States. So in that sense, I think American popular culture, certainly American music, one can say the same thing about, is very prevalent in Europe and very often becomes the thing that most people mean when they talk about or complain about Americanization.
Okay, now, when we move to the next topic, here's where you're going to lose many of our listeners. I think most people are nodding in approval, yes, this is absolutely right. But now you qualify it. You don't agree that this is necessarily a one-way street, American influence on Europe. In fact, you even go so far as to suggest that a certain Europeanization of American culture takes place. Tell us about that.
Well, I mean that in two senses. First of all, American culture has obviously been transmitted to Europe, but what's interesting is the way Europeans use, modify, and adjust to that culture and really transform it to their own needs. That's one sense in which the Europeanization of American culture has taken place. But if one looks at the very nature of American culture itself, it has been heavily dependent, and still is, on European and indeed other foreign influences as well. Hollywood, for example, was an international community. Indeed, it was an immigrant creation and an international industry from the very beginning, and it remains so in terms of the talent both in front of and behind the camera. Disneyland, when Walt Disney was first thinking about creating a theme park in Southern California, one of his models was Tivoli Gardens in Copenhagen. Much of American intellectual life has been shaped by European concerns and European ideas. American painting has certainly been shaped by European influences. So part of what I mean about the Europeanization of American culture is the dependence of American culture, of American artists and entertainers on European ideas and European influences. Now, what America has done is transform those influences into something new and then retransmitted them back to Europe in altered forms. The relationship is really reciprocal. It's a two-way street. It's not simply that America transmits and everybody else all over the world sits almost like robots ingesting the messages that come from the American media.
Are we talking, and this may be a step too far to take, but are we getting to the point where we're talking about a single culture that's sort of adapted locally to local cultural situations?
Well, in part, yes. I think every culture doesn't simply mindlessly absorb other cultural influences. They modify and transform those influences to adjust to their own traditions, their own tastes, and their own needs. But at the present moment, it would be, I think, increasingly difficult to talk about a common culture, given the substantive and profound disagreements that exist between Europe and the United States, which I think involve not only disagreements about policy, but disagreements about values as well.
Globalization is a buzzword, although we're hearing less of it nowadays. How does that factor into what you're talking about?
I think globalization has always coexisted with nationalism, and I think that's as true today as it was 10 or 20 years ago when people first started using the word globalization. Some people think of globalization as simply another word for an Americanization, but I think if you look at the ways in which other societies, and in this case European societies, have evolved, say over the past 50 years, the differences are as important as the similarities, and that's what I mean when I say that I think nationalism, political, economic, and cultural nationalism, is still alive and well. In addition to which, of course, the European community has been trying to organize itself to some extent as an alternative to what American power and what American values stand for. And that, too, I think, is a modification, at the very least, of what many people think of as globalization.
Okay, let's talk about that and focus in on the last few years, because your book was published in, 1997, and you've
That's
been
right.
back and forth and done some more
yes.
research. Any major changes that we should be aware of since 1997?
Well, I think it's certainly clear over the past couple of years that the tensions between the United States and Europe have grown, perhaps to a greater extent than I can certainly remember personally, or that one, I think, would testify to just in terms of a study of history. There have always been tensions. There have always been disagreements about policy, whether it was the Vietnam War, or whether it was the Cold War, or whether it was other aspects of the differences between American and European policy. Those tensions have often also been escalated or reinforced by, again, the kinds of cultural prejudices on both sides of the Atlantic that we talked about at the very beginning. But it does seem to me that over the past 2 years, the discrepancies between America and Europe in terms of the way they look at the world have grown. And I don't think that gulf is noticeably narrowing, at least not at the moment or in the foreseeable future.
You're talking about political and sort of geopolitical clashes and misunderstandings, view of the world, and that translates into cultural influences?
Well, no, what I'm saying is that often the misunderstandings become heightened
okay.
by cultural misunderstandings.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I do appreciate it. We're out of time, and thanks for joining us today.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Richard Pels, professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin and the author of Not Like Us, How Europeans Have Loved, Hated, and Transformed American Culture Since World War II, published by Basic Books. This is Talking History. Our guest commentator this week, Alice George, sheds light on President George W. Bush's leadership in Iraq by comparing it to the actions taken by President John Kennedy during the Cuban Missile Crisis. International crises are commonplace in every presidential administration. How each president handles such crises, however, varies and can make a significant difference in how they are resolved or not. Alice George is the author of Awaiting Armageddon, How Americans Faced the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Nothing better illustrates deterioration in presidential leadership than comparing John F. Kennedy's handling of the Cuban Missile Crisis with George W. Bush's approach to Iraq. In 1962, Kennedy led the nation away from the abyss of nuclear war. Today, Bush has brought us to a different abyss, an ill-defined conflict with impossible goals. Both Kennedy and Bush faced a nation hobbled by a new sense of vulnerability. In 1962, the Soviet Union placed nuclear missiles in Cuba, raising the threat of world war. And on September 11, 2001, terrorists using airliners as weapons diminished Americans' feeling of security. But where Kennedy displayed caution, Bush has moved recklessly. To avert nuclear exchanges, Kennedy compromised and limited their likelihood. To eliminate fierce enemies, Bush attacked and increased their numbers. While Kennedy had irrefutable proof of missiles in Cuba before acting, Bush sent troops into Iraq with no proof of weapons of mass destruction. On several occasions, Kennedy rejected military advice to make a preemptive strike against Cuba, in part because he feared accidental civilian casualties such as those incurred in Iraq and Afghanistan under the leadership of Bush, who seems unwilling to overrule the military. To avoid creating panic, Kennedy urged civil defense agencies to quietly heighten readiness. However, the Bush administration repeatedly has frightened the public with questionable terror alerts. By anticipating international repercussions and trying to understand Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev's motives, Kennedy achieved removal of the missiles. Conversely, Bush has thumbed his nose at the court of world opinion and reinforced the nation's image as an arrogant superpower, dismaying some of our allies, stimulating Arab anger, and guaranteeing additional U.S. casualties. Bush has also avoided examining a vital question: why the United States engenders such loathing in some places. Finally, Kennedy never allowed fears to stifle our ideals, but the Bush administration has imprisoned hundreds of suspected terrorists without due process of law. As Kennedy demonstrated, prudence is just as crucial as vigilance in a dangerous world. Despite huge military and financial commitments, Bush cannot hope to capture every potential terrorist. Hate is the real enemy, and he has invigorated its breeding ground.
You've been listening to Alice George, the author of Awaiting Armageddon, How Americans Faced the Cuban Missile Crisis. George's commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Service.
Like Bill Peace title, "Oh Lord, don't let them drop that atomic bomb on me."
And finally, we continue with our reading of another passage from the unpublished Civil War diary of J.C. Wilmarth, Union soldier from Massachusetts. Last week, Wilmarth finally got to leave the infamous Andersonville prison. Through the months of October and November 1864, Wilmarth was transported from one Confederate prison to another through Georgia and into South Carolina. Conditions are better, but morale continues to be low. Wilmarth comments on Union prisoners who agree to fight for the South in order to be free, and on the prisoner exchange the others hope for but never seems to come. November 6, 1864. I wonder what these godforsaken Rebs will do next to help the rebellion. There are two rebels in officer's uniform in camp recruiting Union prisoners, and they're taking them out by hundreds. It makes many of the prisoners mad to see some take the oath to serve the rebels faithfully, and they strip the healthy-looking ones of most of their clothing. Some large, healthy-looking men with two blankets and who have been prisoners but a short time join the graybacks, and these men get roughly handled by the prisoners who hate the rebels so badly. November 25th. The Rebs tell us that what has stopped the exchange so long is the question of exchanging the colored men. As there are only a few of this class, I've never seen 100 all told, I should think they could fix it some way. I'm not dead yet, and I'm bound not to die just yet unless the Johnnies get mad at my long life and put a ball through me. November 28th. Arrived at Savannah at daybreak. Waited at this place until about 9 o'clock. Streets are nearly deserted. Orders to get aboard the Charleston cars. Now we are disappointed. Another bullpen can be heard by many of the poor mortals that were talking so hopefully last night of home and friends in the happy North. Arrived at Charleston at 9 o'clock in the evening. Next time, Wilmarth finally gets to go home. And that's it for another week of Talking History. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Fiona Beat, the producer. Our radio engineer is Alex Smith. To learn more about Talking History, visit our website at oah.org. And you can send us your comments by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by regular mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. A Moment in Time is produced by Dan Roberts and distributed by WCVE-FM in Richmond, Virginia. For more information, visit the website, amomentintime.com. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LaVoe.